Hello there, my friends. Chris Marcus here with you for Arcadia Economics, and we are continuing on our book with the coverage of the silver market, all the fascinating things that have been going on, and really excited to have a guest today, Bart Chilton, former commissioner of the CFTC, now hosts Boom Bust on RT America, who has such a fascinating perspective of what's been going on in the metals, and to the degree that obviously we're not going to ask you to share anything, not anything that's not confidential, but lots of topics to dig into. So Bart, thank you so much for joining me. It's great to have you here today.
Well, I appreciate your service and you looking at these issues, Chris, and working on the book, and these pieces will be an important integral part of that. So I'm honored to spend some time with you, Chris.
Well, appreciate that. And I guess just to start, maybe if you give people a quick rundown of your background, especially at the CFTC, and just for those who might not be aware, what the CFTC's role is in policing the markets, and then maybe we can get into some of the other topics from there.
Sure. My first job out of high school was in a steel mill, and so I sort of became a guy that had sympathy for average folks, average working folks, and then I spent 30 years in government, both in the House, the Senate, different administrations, Republicans, Democrats, but always tried to look out for those average folks back from the steel mills and others like them. And I carried that to my last government job, which, as you say, was a commissioner at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And it's a little of a tongue twister acronym, but I always tried to make the case that what we did, the markets that we policed, which are commodity markets that deal with things like soybeans and cattle and oil and gold and silver, those are integrally important to everything that goes on in our lives. You know, whether or not it's, you know, transportation because of oil or eating because of food, they make the world go round. So we are really the sister agency, the CFTC, to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And we looked over the commodity markets to ensure that they were free of fraud, manipulation, and malfeasance the best we could. We caught a lot of bad guys, but there's still a lot of bad guys and gals out there. There were then, there continue to be today. But it's a rewarding job. And in that position, I was able to, because you can't be fired, Chris, I was able to say what I wanted. I did so for anybody who was paying attention. And I was particularly tough on large financial institutions, but not only then, any market participant who violated the law, I was tough on. But I certainly did not spare the large banks. You can name any one of them, and I was pretty tough on them and vocally tough on them. So it was a great job and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's an important role in the market. And obviously in the silver community, we've heard a lot about the CFTC and allegations of inappropriate behavior in the market. How did you first hear about that? Was it when Andrew McGuire contacted you back? I believe it was 2009 or 2010. Or how did you first become aware of the premise that many felt something might not be right in silver, gold as well, but primarily silver?
Emails. Andrew did contact me, but he wasn't the first. And I think Ted Butler contacted me, some other people contacted me, and many others, I mean, hundreds of others contacted me through emails, and I responded to every one of them, every one of them that wasn't calling me a rat or other names, I responded to them. And all times of the day, I responded to them, and all through the weekend, I responded to them, and I ended up being the only commissioner, there were five commissioners at CFTC, who felt like it was a responsibility to do so. Matter of fact, the other commissioners all got those emails blocked from their computers, which I found pretty disappointing. The market participants, those in the U.S. especially, but even others should have regulators be accountable to them. And so they they were all complaining, but they didn't have any hard evidence. They just said, well, you know, the price should be higher. And then it wasn't until the whistleblower, silver whistleblower, Andrew McGuire, over in London, got on the phone with me, and he sent me some emails, and he described what he thought might happen. And he did it over a series of maybe a month or 6 weeks. He said that, you know, watch the market between this time and that time. And a lot of these were around the openings, by the way.
Right.
And I bet you the price goes up, or I bet you the price goes down, or whatever he would suggest. And it didn't occur every time, but like 7 out of 10 times he was right. And so that gave me some evidence that said that there's something going on here. And that's when I asked for the enforcement folks to open an investigation. Other commissioners had agreed with that. And so what began a too long investigation started with that.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating. Again, I remember reading that exchange with Andrew McGuire, and I believe it was Elliot Ramirez, where, like you said, he pointed out some manipulations, and I've heard you comment how a lot of these did play out, not every time. As that investigation was going on, obviously there was that memorable 2010 meeting. One thing that I was always confused about was, my understanding was that was shortly after the emails that McGuire sent, and then I remember he was supposed to appear at the meeting, but then somehow was canceled. Are you able to comment at all on what happened? Because I think that's something that a lot of people have been confused by, where I agree and appreciate what you said and can confirm how when that you did respond to people's emails, although it often felt to folks like a lot of the other commissioners weren't doing the same thing. And curious what happened where McGuire was not allowed to speak at that.
I'm not sure that that's the case. You know, you have to check the record, but I don't know that he was, banned from speaking or anything. I remember that I included Bill Murphy with GATA on the gold front in that meeting. And I'm not sure if Ted Butler came to that meeting or not. I certainly don't recall that Andrew wasn't invited or that he was not allowed to come. That's not my recollection of what happened, but he wasn't there. But I don't know that he wanted to testify. Once you become a whistleblower, you provide your evidence and your information to the investigators. And I know that he did sit down with investigators, or at least on the phone, maybe in person, and speak with them. We had the information, would it have been better if he wanted to have it out in the public? Probably. But as far as I know, he wasn't banned or anything from that. But you could ask him. I still am in contact with Andrew pretty regularly. He's a gem of a person and honest and credible character by any stretch of the imagination. So I'm sure he'd tell you.
Yeah, well, we're hoping to get him on board for this. So we'll look forward to running that by him. Along the lines of that meeting, I was actually watching one of the videos again the other day. And I know between Jeff Christian and Adrian Douglas, they were disputing whether the metal is actually there to back the paper claims, whether via contracts on the COMEX or derivatives. Curious your thoughts. It seems to me like we're in a situation where we now have a fractional banking system in the metals. From what you've seen, is there actually metal in existence that these claims could be fulfilled, or is there an imbalance in there somewhere?
There's never, in silver, in soybeans, in oil, there's never enough physical to back up all of the contracts, the futures contracts. Never is. I think a good gauge was like 10 to 1. I'm not sure that ain't in silver, but an overarching among all commodities, 10 to 1. You know, futures are essentially, and traders hate when I say this, but they're essentially bets. They're gambles. Right. And they don't play out. No, everybody's not collecting them all at the same time. When there's an expiration, people get out of the contracts because nobody wants to hold on to a bunch of crude oil. They don't have enough swimming pools around in their yards. So there's never enough. And that fact that there's never enough seemed to me to be some, you know, basis for a lot of the conspiracy theorists in the silver community. Well, it's not there, so it must be, you know, messed up. There must be something sneaky going on. But it happens with every single commodity. It's not, it's how the system's worked. Now, you can debate whether or not it's good or bad or not, but, you know, if you want a futures contract, you're going to have more out there in contracts than there is physical supply for. Just the way it is, they're futures contracts. Look, there's a lot of other things that I think were shady in the silver market, but the fact that there wasn't enough silver to back up all the futures contracts, which would never be redeemed at the same time anyway, I think was just sort of a Trojan horse to get into sort of nutty conversations at times.
Right. Although you mentioned that there were many other things you saw that did raise the alarm, anything that you can get into, again, while respecting the confidentiality with the agency, but some of the things that you did see that raised your attention?
Well, there's some stuff that's out there in the public that I'm not sure everybody, you know, put together. Most people did. I would never, for example, and I won't now, say that, you know, there was a bank and name it that held, you know, close to 40% of the silver market at one point. But the news reports, I mean, people surmise it's JP Morgan Chase, and the news reports in the public record showed that when Bear Stearns collapsed, that their silver positions got transferred over to JP Morgan. Mm-hmm. And we, the CFTC, had to approve those positions because the Bear Stearns positions, the Bear Stearns positions, when they came over, combined with JP's positions, were so large that they violated the position limits on which one trader could hold. So the CFTC had to approve that JP could take on the Bear silver positions. So people want to do the math, they can do the math on who had the largest silver. But there was an exception there that we made, and that's in the public record. What's not really looked at too much is that we made that allowance for a time certain, and I forget exactly how long it was, but it was not years. It was, you know, months. Maybe it was 3 months or 6 months, or maybe it was 9 months. I think it was probably six, but I don't recall. And that allowance was for them to be able to get out of those positions. Right. Well, one thing we didn't know right at first is that there was the head silver trader for Bear. He went with the silver positions to JP, and so he's trading at JP. And after this time was coming to an end, the runway which we had given for them to get out of the positions in excess of position limits, they were nowhere close to getting out of them. Matter of fact, at one point, they'd bought even more,
right,
which was like direct, you know, conflict of what we had in mind. And so they were granted a little bit more time, a couple of months, as I recall, and they did ultimately get down to the position. But it was at that time that when they were so large, that I made the comment about how large a particular bank was in the market, which sort of shocked people. And it shocked me, quite frankly, that it was so large. So anyway, these were very troubling times, and a lot of this was going on then, the accused manipulation, and it was a really time certain period at which our investigators were looking at market participants, including those at that institution that had such large positions, to ensure that everything was okay. And the bottom line is we found a lot of things that indicated things were not okay. I talked about that a little bit.
Yeah, and for folks who might be a little bit newer to it, can you explain why the, you know, big concentrated position is something that the CFT looks for and is on the watch for, to be careful about, and how that impacts the market or has the potential to impact the market?
Well, I mean, if you and I are trading in the futures markets, you know, for a personal account, nobody's going to notice. But if you've got a sizable position and you trade that sizable position, it's the one thing if you just have it. But if you're trading it, that, you know, all of a sudden 20% of the market goes long or goes short, that can move markets.
Right.
And so that's why there are not what I want with regard to position limits. So that's a whole nother topic of further position limits. But there are some position limits in what is called the spot month. That's the delivery month. That month where you hope everybody doesn't get a, you know,
right,
a pool full of oil. So there are limits in the spot months. There's not limits in what we call the back month. That's every month other than the spot months, or all months combined, which would be the spot month and the back months. Those limits I pushed for, but have not been put in place, even though they're required by law. But those limits can traders that have large positions that are approaching those limits or above those limits or limits or had an exemption from those limits, they are particularly traders that could roil markets with large trades. So it doesn't mean that they're a problem just because they have the positions, but they're certainly suspect. And regulators look at those sorts of things because they can push or pull markets around inappropriately, and that can damage a lot of average folks and a lot of other traders.
Right. And again, you mentioned the position that went from Bear Stearns to JP Morgan, and also that was in 2008 when we saw silver go from about $21 to $9. Do you think that those two were connected, and that position that JP Morgan eventually had the waiver for had an influence on the price back then?
Don't know. I mean, I was about to say I can't say, but it's not that I can't say, because the truth is I don't know.
Right. Fair enough. Curious.
I saw no evidence of such.
Okay. Another year that we had a wild series of price moves in silver was obviously 2011. Again, we had Bernanke in, I believe it was October of 2010, launch QE2. I bought a 1,000-ounce block of silver in response to that. So again, it just, in the sense that it was logical to me that part of the run-up was in response to a lot of money printing. We hit $49 in April, and then the price crashed down and been in a bear market ever since then. Any thoughts on anything you'd like to comment on about the price, especially in 2011, or what's happened since?
Well, you know, a lot of these, I mean, when precious metals essentially, you know, are their safe haven. So when you see things like you saw, why you bought, makes all the sense in the world. But you know, ideally, these things are supposed to operate under market fundamentals, and those involve supply, demand, and they involve the number of traders out there and who's willing to risk and how long they're willing to risk it. So, you know, I'm away from it now. I mean, we cover on our television program, we look at precious metals all the time, but I'm certainly not in a position now to see anything in markets that if something untoward was going on, I wouldn't necessarily, I wouldn't know about it. I certainly wouldn't know the details about it. But I can tell you, things were suspect, and the investigation that we did uncovered a lot of evidence that would lead to a manipulation case or an attempted manipulation case. But the standard of evidence, the cumulative standard of evidence, was a very high bar. And so while we did have evidence, direct evidence, you know, voicemail evidence, text evidence, trading evidence, at some point we had price movement evidence, but we never had all of the things that you needed together in one place that were enough for us to go after. There were just holes, and it was frustrating. And we looked at it a bunch of different ways, and at one point we even thought we had enough to go forward with the case. And we asked for some forensic economist outside of the CFTC to examine it. And they came back and they said, no, we don't think so. And that was after about 4 years, by the way. I've never talked about this. That was after about 4 years. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. We thought we had enough evidence and we hire somebody outside and they say, we don't have enough evidence. Let's go to somebody else. So people don't know this part, but I extended the investigation yet another year because I didn't believe it. And so we went to yet another forensic economist and had them look at it. And they came back with the opinion of the first folks that we didn't have the traders and we didn't have the market participants dead to rights. But we had lots of stuff. And we had real stuff that would have played really well in court, not just numbers, but the rhetoric, the banter between traders that we had. And I'm not saying there was lots of it, but there was enough of it that it was damning. But the damning part had to be backed up by other requirements of evidence under the law. And we didn't get all of that. We didn't get to that. It troubled me so much, by the way, that I did seek a change in the law, and we ultimately got it. And we have there's a newer, lower standard for manipulation that's been in place since that time. It was not retroactive. A lower standard of manipulation for the CFTC, which is similar to the SEC's standard for manipulation, or one of their standards, I think it's their 10B5 standard, which is based upon recklessness. So instead of having these four different hurdles that I was describing earlier that were pretty high for us to get over, the new standard that I fought for, and Murray Cantwell was the champion in the Senate and in Congress on this, by the way, although there were others, Bernie Sanders, et cetera, but Murray Cantwell was the real champion, that now there's a lower manipulation standard, one that would be easier to prove. You know, would the same evidence back then result in a charge and a potential conviction on manipulation? I think so. I think so. You know, it's something that we'll never see. It's not, it wasn't a grandfathered thing. The law was the law then. And I'm glad we changed it, but it may be one of the small little, for lack of a better word, silver rays of light in this whole torrid debacle.
Yeah, that's really fascinating to hear you mention that. Again, a lot of this I've followed and is certainly interesting, especially since in the time after that, we've had Deutsche Bank have a settlement where they released some trader transcripts, which were not very positive. And then, of course, more recently, we had a former JP Morgan trader, John Edmonds, plead guilty to the Department of Justice. I thought it was particularly interesting that he mentioned that what he did. Now, he pled guilty to spoofing, but mentioned that it was with the knowledge of his superiors and widespread practice at the firm. Would love to hear any thoughts you have on that, because essentially, maybe further verification of what you were investigating and advocating and just talking about as well.
Well, spoofing is another thing that wasn't against the law when a lot of these nefarious trades were taking place. Spoofing was a Dodd-Frank invention. It's another thing I worked on. And another thing that Maria Cantwell worked on, by the way. And spoofing is essentially tantamount to being part and parcel of manipulation. You spoof to manipulate markets. I mean, you spoof to push markets up or down, and then you take the opposite position, right? So it was, we ultimately, I forget when we did the rule, because even though you passed the law, once the law is passed, then you have to promulgate. Tough word, but promulgate is the word we use for actually implementing the rule, and that took a while. So we had to define what the word spoofing meant, and more importantly, what it didn't mean, because people take gambles in markets all the time, but essentially sending out false price signals on trades that you never intend to execute. And that phrase, never intend, is a tough one to define, because how can you divine somebody's intent? I said, well, Chris, I intended on doing it. You say, oh, no, you didn't. Well, how do you know I didn't intend on it? So it's a sort of a weasel word, but we did the best we could on it, and that's another thing that although the statute's been used effectively, used against an HFT trader in Chicago a couple times, actually. So the law is working, but all of these laws, whether or not it's the recklessness manipulation standard I mentioned, whether or not it's spoofing or any other law or rule or regulation, these things need to constantly be living documents to ensure that they are keeping up with market participants and what they're doing, because these traders that they'll look for any way to get a competitive advantage, and sometimes that enters an area that is a little gray, and sometimes if they get into that gray area, they will really take advantage of it, and regulators and lawmakers need to be aware of that and constantly devising the rules and regulations and updating them so that they're appropriate for the circumstances, so that we don't have an environment like we did with silver, where we had all sorts of evidence and just couldn't get them because the law, the rules, regs were too stringent. I mean, the stuff we had was pretty damning, but just not enough.
Yeah, and certainly from my experience on Wall Street, I can confirm what you're saying about how, unfortunately, if you leave a little room for error, some traders out there will try and exploit that. Again, I appreciate you mentioning the spoofing. Curious, because my understanding of how some of the manipulation has occurred is that, if silver is trading $20.05, there's a lot of stop orders placed around the $20 handle. So often if the price can get pushed a little bit, then you get a lot of those high frequency algorithms kicking in, and then you'll see a drop, with many feeling that people kind of nudging a little are then able to buy lower. Does that sound like a reasonably accurate portrayal to put it in perspective to folks, or would you phrase it differently?
Well, it's a good portrayal, but it's a very good portrayal. But it's actually also a reflection of what I was just speaking about, of how trading has changed. So even back in 2008, 9, 10, maybe a little bit of 11, even when a lot of these silver trades and some gold trades were pretty suspect when you're looking at them, you didn't have high frequency traders in these markets like you do today.
Right.
And they're still not all over them, but spoofing meant one thing when it was, you know, an average person out there, you know, saying they're going to sell 100 lots of something and trying to tick the price up a penny. And then once it goes up, then they offer, you know, half a penny. Mm-hmm. If they get it to go up a penny, they offer half a penny and they make a half a penny where they weren't going to make anything. And then they pull back those other offers for a penny, right? So they say, I'll sell these things for a penny more than anybody else is offering. And the price ticks up, and a couple of people may take advantage, but then they pull back the offer real quick, and then they say, now I'll sell it for this amount, and they get a bunch of buyers. So markets are changing, and so you have these high-frequency traders who are getting into more and more areas, and at first they weren't into futures. They weren't into commodities, but now they're getting into them, particularly oil, some of the larger trader T-bills. And they're getting into gold and silver. No less so like pork bellies and live cattle and stuff. But, what they want is volume by frequency traders. I call them cheetahs. Not because they're like Boston card cheaters, but because they're fast, like the market cheetahs, right. Cheetahs in the jungle. And they're trying to prey upon any little time lapse that they can see, but they got to have volume to make those changes. And they serve a purpose, the cheetahs, because they add liquidity to markets. So if there's somebody who wants to buy or sell, cheetahs will take them. They'll do it. They're just going to offload it one way or another in the meantime, and they'll be so quick that they're trying to make just little micro pennies in nanoseconds. So the difference in your description is that today, when a market moves because of a spoof, it can move a lot more. So, you know, maybe 2-3 times in history, you heard about a flash crash.
Right.
But it really wasn't until May 6, 2010, that when we had this major flash crash that impacted, started in S&P Mini at Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group. And then there was contagion, the S&P 500 mini futures contract. Then there was contagion into the related equities markets. It wasn't until then that people really started to hear this term flash crash. And since that time, there's been, you know, a dozen, 15 of them. And we had a big investigation back then on that one that I pointed to with the SEC and the CFTC. And it still stands as a really hard look at what was going on. But the bottom line is HFTs were involved in the markets. They didn't do anything wrong. We thought they might have, but there was never any cases that came out of it. But we thought they may have. But the bottom line is they're doing what they do. They're into markets. They're into markets when markets were going down. They saw this 75,000 lot being traded, and they just took advantage of it. And they traded and traded and traded and traded and traded, and they took the other side, and the market went down faster than anybody thought it ever had.
Right.
It flash crashed. And then, fortunately, because they were in the market, the untold story, the other part of that story, is that if the HFTs actually helped bring the price back up, because while it crashed, I think AT&T went down to a penny, their stock went down to a penny,
wow.
That it was The HFTs were in the market taking advantage of the buyback too. So markets are different now. So to my point about trying to make sure that regulations are right-sized, you know, we wrote the spoofing law, you know, it was a Dodd-Frank thing, didn't get implemented for a couple more years. Is it correct as written now? Now, it's been used effectively, so a lot of people, a lot of regulators probably say, yeah, sure, it's been used, it's great, no problem. I'd say it's worth a look-see, given what we know about how many times traders are trading. I mean, there are times, Chris, I love this figure because it's so amazing. There are times that we looked at, particularly during the close, where high-frequency traders are trading 450 to 500 times in the aggregate, 450, all of them, 450 to 500 times per second, Crazy numbers. Yep. Like how do you, you know, how do you analyze, and then they want somebody to analyze those trades per second, 450 to 500 times. So we're in a whole new world of trading, and we need to ensure that the laws are updated to have an environment in which we can endeavor to the fullest extent to catch the bad guys and those who are trying to being bad actors in these important markets that impact the economic engine of our democracy.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's fascinating the way finance has changed, the world has changed, everything's so digital. We're not using hand signals on the floor to do everything anymore.
Right.
Perhaps just the final question before we wrap up and let you go, as I sure do appreciate your time today. Just with the JP Morgan case with the Department of Justice, again, no one knows the future, but do you have any thoughts on how that plays out and whether you think maybe some of the things that you and the CFTC were trying to bring to light that perhaps the Department of Justice will be able to do so going forward?
Well, nothing specific, Chris, but I can tell you that during this whole time when we were doing the investigation, something that wasn't covered, because there really wasn't any action or really no reason to cover it, I guess, but was that we were keeping DOJ up to date on what we were doing. They had a couple of briefings during it ended up being 5 years in total of the investigation. I can't tell you how many times we were briefed on it, dozens and dozens and dozens. And I had, you know, probably, you know, 100 meetings on silver separate from those commission briefings. But there were ongoing conversations with DOJ about what we were finding, and they wanted to be updated. But when we said we weren't going forward, they said, well, they're not going forward either. They usually take these things as a referral, and fortunately, they are real serious about it. Unfortunately, they don't have the manpower to DOJ to go after as many bad actors as I think the country deserves. Back in the day, and I'm talking, you know, back during this time period, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, only about 75% of the referrals that we sent to DOJ only about 25%, 75% they rejected. Only 25% did they accept.
Right.
And we never sent them something that we didn't win on. We weren't like sending them things, oh, we didn't get this, maybe you can. No, these were all things that we won on, that we got a conviction or a settlement. These were, you know, we were winners on these things. And we said, we think that, you know, you should put the folks behind bars. And I don't have anything negative to say about any individuals at DOJ. I think this is a reflection of Congress and budget policies about where staff resources need to go, and DOJ criminal division is one that deserves certainly more resources, and the number of referrals rejected is less over at the SEC. It was back then. I don't know, remember the number, but it still was above 50%. I can't tell you what it was. It may have been 60%. But it was less than ours, but it was still above 50%. I remember that. And so lots of bad actors may have been fined. But as that old detective series where now a lot of people remember, Beretta used to say, if you do the crime, you should do the time, not just pay a fine. And so more people, I think, should be doing time when they violate these important financial laws.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. And fortunately, as I get, I've crossed 40 in the past year, I'm getting better at accepting what we can change and what we can't. And while there's certain things that are out of our control, I really do appreciate how you've, all the effort that you've put into this over the year. Again, I contacted the five CFTC commissioners a couple of years back. And like you mentioned before, you were the only one to respond. And I think especially when people see things going on, you know, obviously we all want things to be fair, but really even just having someone that's accountable and comes on and speaks and lets folks know what's going on. Truly grateful for what you're doing, what you've done, and sure the great things you'll be doing going forward. So perhaps just to close out, maybe one last time you could mention the show and where people can find you and stay up to date on the great research you're doing.
Sure. Well, I've been really pleased. I've been doing this show on RT America, and it's broadcast globally. And it's great because it's a business and finance show. It's every day a week. It's called Boom Bust. And you can get it in the U.S. a bunch of places. You get it DirecTV DirecTV and Dish. And I think we're off Comcast right now. We'll be back soon. Or you can always check it out at youtube.com/boombustrt. And I continue to have, I think, a different voice in finance and business. And I continue to call them as they see them and as I see them. And you can check us out there. Thank you so much, Chris. Sure appreciate the time that you are willing to devote to this important subject. And feel free to let me know if I can ever be of help in the future.
Well, I sure appreciate that, Bart. That's kind of you to say. You've been a big help in my career, just helping me to see some of these things and keep going. So really great pleasure to catch up with you today. And thanks so much for joining. And look forward to staying in touch, my friend.
Good luck, my friend. Thank you.